vermin like cockroaches and rats or mice. And, you know, it was just sort of everywhere and we never really cleaned particularly well.
On a number of occasions, people have actually seen the image of a burning airman running through the forest.
I went out to my favourite bar and I started talking to this guy. You know, we seemed to be hitting it off pretty well, like it was flowing quite freely. So we ended up exchanging numbers, and then the next day he texted me and, you know, just asking how my weekend was, blah, 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 blah. It turned out the conversation was like a little bit more dull when there wasn't a few glasses of wine involved. And after maybe two or three text messages, he kind of just went out on a limb and was like, hey, like, what are you doing this weekend? Let's go get a drink. And I kind of freaked out a little bit and I was like, oh, this is very forward. I'm not actually sure that I'm ready for this. I'm not actually that interested in this guy. So I actually didn't reply, which in retrospect was probably one of my more immature moments. But I just kind of thought, oh, well, the chances of me seeing this guy again are very low.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Gruth. This week, we're going ghosting. Here's Ella.
About a month later, I went back to this same bar and I saw him again. And I was freaking out because I felt really bad. And so I just kind of ignored him for the whole night until he kind of came up to me, grabbed me and was like, why didn't you respond to my text? And started like getting visibly upset. And I eventually kind of just made up a bit of a lie and said, well, I dropped my phone in the bath. And he didn't believe me, but eventually I convinced him that it was true and that I'd gotten a new phone and I didn't have his number and I felt really awful. So the next day he texted me again, just asking me how the rest of my night was and what my plans were for the rest of the weekend. And I was like, yeah, you know, just Netflix, food, the usual. What about you? And so he came back and he said, oh, you know, just found an $800 chainsaw on the side of the road. What a score. And so at this point, my housemate and I started freaking out because we were like, okay, what kind of guy needs an $800 chainsaw? Why does he know the value of a chainsaw? Why does he see a chainsaw on the side of the road and decide to pick it up? And why is he telling me this? So we were just getting a bit paranoid about this guy being a bit of a weirdo, but I still felt so bad about the ghosting thing that I was like, okay, I'm still going to reply. I'm not going to ghost him again. And so I replied and said, haha, well, what do you need an $800 chainsaw for exactly? And then he never replied. So I'm not sure if this entire situation was just him wanting to exact revenge for ghosting him by ghosting me back. But I gotta say, I was a bit offended, even though I was not interested in this guy whatsoever.
In our next story, a part-time job in a Melbourne food court takes an unexpected turn.
It's lunchtime. I'm here in a food court right in the middle of the city between two skyscrapers. All the office workers have come down for lunch and the place is packed. Every shop has a huge line out the front and the staff are struggling to keep up. But there's one shop with no customers. It's closed down. The windows are covered in paper so you can't see inside, and there's a sign on the door that promises something else is opening up soon.
Up until early last year, this place sold smoothies, but really fancy upmarket smoothies, like $12 smoothies. Like a lot of cafes and restaurants, it was staffed by students trying to pay their way through uni.
I remember thinking it was so clean and like upmarket and really like swanky.
This is Tess. She was hired while she was doing her arts degree.
It had this beautiful like white tiled sort of like counter and these beautiful wooden benches and swanky blenders and like this really nice POS system.
POS is point of sale. It's the computer system that a lot of restaurants use to take orders on.
At this shop, there were iPads instead of the clunky old tills that a lot of businesses tend to have. It was a pretty sweet uni job. There were free food and drinks, it was pretty easy work, plus there was a street cred of working in a place that was Instagram famous.
I think it was very much trying to be like that modern Instagram. Like it was literally trying to be the aesthetic of Instagram.
This is Helena. She worked in the store from the very first day that it opened. She says that in those early days, the store did pretty well. It was a bit of a passion project for the owner, and she was determined.
But like, she was very excited about it, like being successful. And it kind of was. I think we opened in August, and then that year it was a really hot summer. It was like the heat wave of 40 degree days, like 5 days in a row. So everyone wanted smoothies, everyone wanted juices. And it was right in the health trend of Melbourne. So everyone was like, yes, vegan smoothies, this is where I'm at.
The first year or so were great. The shop was popular, the staff were happy, things were looking good. But it all started going downhill when one of the managers left the business.
Someone was brought in to cover her, like, briefly, and it would last maybe like 6 months or something, and then they'd leave, and then the next manager would come in, and then they'd leave. So it was just like constantly new managing systems.
There was a lot of uncertainty about who was in charge and who was meant to do what. Eventually, there was just no manager at all. The girls were left alone in the store, all day, every day.
At the same time, the store was getting less and less popular. People had moved on. The trend was over and smoothies were out. There were days when the store barely managed to bring in a dozen customers. The girls passed the time by studying, snacking, or just chatting.
We used to open at 8 and no one would come in till like 9:15. Like, it was sort of that kind of shop where you could just do whatever.
The smoothie bar wasn't the owner's only business. She actually had a dozen or so restaurants and takeaway shops that were really successful. If you live in Melbourne, you've eaten at least one of them. As the smoothie bar really began to fail, the owner sort of disappeared. It wasn't uncommon for her to be super busy for months at a time, but this just seemed different.
She was really engaged at the time that I started working there, was always in store, was always checking up on us, seemed to like care the way that like, you know, a normal boss does. And I was like, so now you're kind of stepping back from this. Are you stepping back because everything's failing or you've got a new interest?
There was a team of admin staff who did the behind the scenes work for all the owners' businesses. So that's who was managing the financial stuff and drawing up the rosters. The staff who worked in the store were all students. They were 19 or 20 years old. And like a lot of people their age, the job was just a paycheck. Having hardly any work to do, that was just a bonus. They were still getting paid every week, so there was no real motivation for them to try and help the business out. They hadn't seen the owner in a year, they could see their business was going downhill. So they thought, oh well, may as well make the most of it.
Yeah, it was just a total blatant disregard of all the rules that they'd set up for us and just, you know, being like, well, I don't care, you know, this place is going to shut down anyway, so why would I even bother, like...
The cleaning schedule was completely ignored. The store Spotify playlist was forgotten about. It just became another place to hang out.
And I'd be like, doing an afternoon shift. Literally no one would walk into store. And I'd be like, well, I'll do some food prep out the back. Would like take my laptop out because I would have come from uni and just like watch. I remember watching all of Legally Blonde whilst prepping like oranges one shift.
The store had all kinds of fresh fruits and veggies, as well as stuff like oats, dried fruits, nuts, snacks. But there were no customers to eat it all. With no one around to tell them what to do, the staff just started taking it home before it went bad.
Distinctly, I remember there being cameras, but we didn't know as employees whether they were turned on or not. So it was sort of like this myth of like, the big boss watches us and like Big Brother, like she knows what we're doing. Like if we steal some goji berries, like she's going to know.
Or just handing it out to any customer that seemed nice.
Probably one in every 10 people that walked into store would get like either a free upgrade or like extra stuff in their drink or just a free drink.
In terms of pay versus work, it was the dream job. You could spend your time there reading or studying or just sitting on your phone. But with no one around to crack the whip, things started to get a little gross.
I remember things not being washed properly. I remember seeing vermin like cockroaches and rats or mice. And, you know, it was just sort of everywhere, and we never really cleaned the store particularly well.
A fridge full of fruit and veggies broke down in the summertime, and it was just left to fill up with mould and maggots. The entire floor turned a different colour because the mop was dirtier than the tiles.
We used to make house-made almond milk every morning, which was like a thing. It was like really upmarket and quite cool. Like we'd always tell the customers, yeah, we soak the almonds overnight and then we blend them every morning. We create our own almond milk. It's unsweetened, blah, blah, blah. And then we'd store it in like these ancient milk bottles that had some kind of orange growth growing around the base and like the rim of the handle and up the top. And like we'd use that.
It was getting really hard to hide this stuff from the customers, but the girls couldn't really solve the problems at the store by themselves. And as bad as they felt about serving up dodgy products, they just didn't have the power to make those major changes that this business needed.
I felt like I really wanted to sort of clean everything, but I didn't have the means to do it. And so I'd sort of fall into the habit of like hiding it from the customers, and then, you know, the dirt would get worse or the mold or whatever get worse, and then you'd pour the almond milk away from the customers and just sort of like pick out the dirt from the spinach when you put it in their smoothie, you know, just like all that kind of stuff.
Things were left up to them that shouldn't really have been their responsibility. Like if a customer had a complaint and wanted to speak to the manager, there was none. If there was an issue with the deliveries, they had to deal with it themselves. They were all uni students with their own lives, and now they were somehow managing a smoothie bar by themselves. And they were in no way qualified.
Meh, if you want to close the shop 45 minutes early, whatever. Like, if you don't feel like washing the salary, that's fine. Like, just leave it.
We were working and it was about 4 or 5 p.m. so it was really close to store closing time. I heard this, like, snap. And I, like, knew that it was the mousetrap going off because we had a lot of mousetraps in store. And it was, like, one of those moments where you're like, I don't want to clean that up. I'm not going to clean that up. And you're like, look at the roster the next day and you're like, oh, I'm not working. The person I don't like is working tomorrow. I think I'm just going to leave that for them. And just like left the store closed up, left that dead mouse sitting in store for the whole night.
Things were getting ridiculous. The store was getting grosser and grosser and making less and less money. Staff members resigned, but no one else was hired. The store could only open when people were available to work, so some days it just stayed closed all day.
I do not understand how that business survived as long as it did. I think that business was open for about 3 years, and I don't think it made profit for any of that time. At the time that like the FPOS system like just never got fixed, I was like, this is it. This is when it's going to close down. And like when another smoothie place opened up across the like food court, I was like, we're done. Like surely this is the end. And it just kept going and going. And I was just like, they must be moving, using money from their other businesses. Surely. Like there's no other way they can keep this afloat.
After a long, slow death, a meeting was called. The remaining staff members gathered in the store to hear what they already knew. The owner finally showed up to tell them that the shop wasn't making enough money to stay open. It was over. The mood was half relief, half sadness.
I was really sad when it closed down because not because of the business per se, but like the relationships I'd had there. And, you know, it was fun working there because it was just you and one other girl, one other person, and you just sort of like get along and play music and talk shit all day. Like it was so much fun. And so it was like this weird thing of like, no, I don't really care. And also I'm really sad that it's no longer a thing.
These days, all the staff are working different jobs across Melbourne. Tess teaches English and Helena is studying her honours in chemistry. But they can never forget the store, even if they wanted to.
When I walk around Melbourne and I go into places that look like the shop, like they're really nice, they look upmarket, I'm always thinking, what's it like in the back? Like, is it gross and dingy in the back? Like, is this all just a facade? Like, I always think that.
That story was by Nina Enova, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari. You're listening to All the Best. This week's theme is ghosting.
Odd incidents. Seeing people who were not there, often in period dress. Sound illusions, poltergeist activity, things seeming to move spontaneously of their own accord.
A lot of people think that Canberra doesn't have ghosts because, you know, it's a modern city, it's a new city. You know, there's no ghosts here. But there's actually more reports of hauntings in Canberra per capita than anywhere else in Australia. So you could say Canberra is the ghost capital of the whole country.
This week, I went to Canberra to see my family. Sometimes when I go back, it can feel like a bit of a ghost town. But it turns out I'm just not looking hard enough.
My name is Tim the Yowie Man. Bit of a strange name, I know. But I look for unusual happenings in and around Canberra. That's why I'm called the Yowie, because the Yowie, hairy, ape-like creature. But I also dabble in the paranormal. I became the Yowie Man 25 years ago or something, and I was focused on looking for Yowies, you know, these Bigfoot type creatures. And I guess that's a bit out there, a bit unusual. It's a bit of the unknown, the unexplained. And in doing that, I started to meet a lot of people that were into ghosts, and I became more and more fascinated in ghostly happenings. And actually, on a dinner at a little country town called Bungendore, not far from Canberra, about 20 years ago, I was sitting in the restaurant and I actually saw a ghost. It was my first ghost. It was this man literally running. He was in like 1930s type clothing, and he ran straight down the corridor of this old building called the Carrington and through a locked door. It was definitely a ghost. I wasn't drinking or taking illicit substances. It was something which I could not explain, and I thought people just made them up, or you know, some people, you know, just a bit crazy. But after that encounter, I thought, you know, there's more to ghosts than meets the eye. I want to go and explore. For example, one of my favourites is there's a ghost, you know, Canberra's known for politics, yeah? One of the, and when you think of politics, you think of prime ministers. How many people realise that Canberra is actually home to the ghost of an ex-Australian Prime Minister? His name's Ben Chifley. He lived at a hotel called the Currajong in the 1940s, and when he was there, he actually decided to live there rather than the lodge because he wanted to save money for the government. And he actually lived in a room, basically back then it was a glorified backpacker hostel. So the Prime Minister shared a bathroom with other guests. Anyway, he's in this hotel and he suffered a fatal heart attack in 1951. Fatal heart attack means, of course, he died. He died in a particular room upstairs. And ever since, people that have gone to stay at the hotel, or those that work there, say in that room, sometimes you can actually experience the ghost of Ben Chifley. And he manifests himself in the form of a grey-suited man, and he's pointing towards Old Parliament House.
And that's not the only haunting in our nation's capital.
There's a location called the Air Disaster Memorial, which, as the name implies, a plane crash there in the early 1940s, killing 10 people. And it's a location which is in a pine forest, so it's spooky to start with. And whenever anyone got their license in Canberra for, you know, 20, 30 years, you were dared to go to the Air Disaster Memorial. Can you hang out there without being spooked? And so on my tours, I take people there. It's now behind three locked gates, but we get in. And on a number of occasions on tours, people have actually seen the image of a burning airman running through the forest. Particularly spooky. We've had one occasion where we had to drive all the way out of the forest, which is no mean feat. It's a fair way in, to drop this person back down at the road because he couldn't hack being in the forest. He was just going, he was in tears, he was hysterical, he was just so overwhelmed with sadness of what happened there. Another place where things happen quite regularly is when I do tours at the National Film and Sound Archive. And I think on about 5 or 6 tours in a row last year, we had people really ill that were overcome with some sort of, they said, some sort of feeling of dread, and they actually had to leave the tour. And it was 5 tours in a row, and we can't really understand why that happened, but it all happened in the same spot, in the basement.
Meet Anne Mackay.
My formal job title is Education Coordinator for the National Film and Sound Archive. That's though I like to say that by day I teach the nation's youth about our audiovisual collection, but much to my delight, by night I actually get to show locals and interstate visitors the kind of spooky, ghoulish history of the building that was once the Institute of Anatomy.
This building was originally built to house the anatomy collection of Sir William Mackenzie. According to Anne, his collection had 150 sets of human remains, eventually including his own.
And Mackenzie, in more kind of creepy history to the building, Mackenzie was so devoted to the institution that he'd created that he actually chose to be interred in the building itself behind this very plaque.
And he's just behind that.
He's actually interred in the wall, yes, and the family have checked that, I believe, they've verified it on no less than 2 occasions. So we also have other little markers to his sort of worshipful relationship to science in the busts of various great scientists that we see around the wall. And in more creepy history, 2 of them are in fact death masks, so casts of the faces of the scientists taken after they had died.
With death masks and the founder interred in the walls, maybe it's no surprise that this place has a creepy reputation. The National Film and Sound Archive is reportedly one of the most haunted buildings in the country. A number of staff members have had mysterious encounters. Here's Torsten Kading, the curator of broadcast and sound.
I was working back late one evening with one of my colleagues who went to the toilet. Lovely old toilet, some of the most beautiful toilets in Canberra, actually. And was convinced that I was talking to him while he was on the toilet. So he came back out and back into the office and continued the conversation that we'd been having whilst he was in the cubicle, and I didn't have an idea of what he was talking about. And I said, no, I wasn't anywhere near there. I've been here the whole time. And he just went white as a sheet and went home very quickly.
Certainly to the extent that I've had odd experiences that didn't seem immediately explicable, quite a few of them have happened in this corner of the building, particularly trolleys seeming to spontaneously move themselves into the positions I needed them in and so on, in the basement corridor. And this elevator is famed for being, rather than in any way, I suppose, terrifying in its odd nature, it's famed for being a rather helpful elevator, so staff who have arms full of things and can't reach to press the button, it will often spontaneously appear and open and so forth.
So they're friendly ghosts.
Well, to the extent that it can be measured or is reported in staff's reports of these incidents, yes, they do seem to be friendly rather than in any way malicious, with the possible exception of a presence that's sometimes identified in the corridor just above where we're standing, which is associated with more poltergeist-like activity. So staff who've worked here for many years do report seeing things like sort of dervishes of papers swirling around the room, things moving from the location they've been left in, films in anti-gravity canisters leaping off the walls and seeming to be thrown suddenly to the floor and so forth. So while not associated with any injury or malice of that kind, that particular quadrant of the building, which is one of the old labs, does seem to be associated with more aggressive spiritual encounters, if you choose to classify them as spiritual encounters.
Anne then took me downstairs to the sub-basement level of the building.
We've accessed it from the regular basement. We had to come down a further flight of stairs. And actually today it is used for storage of some of the heritage items. I'm afraid there's not a light in here, I don't think, so you just need to let your eyes adjust a little bit. But you get that kind of musty smell off it. It's certainly very evocative. And you can see there's kind of the sump and everything in the corner still. And these are actually the remnants of the old stage in what is today our theatreette. It's always been a theatre of sorts. It's heritage listed, but we keep the grill itself still in the theatreette because it is associated with one of the more famed ghost stories, which is actually associated with the area I work in by day, which is the education section, because for many years now that theatre has been used to host school excursion groups for education programs here. And there are reports across many years from students from different schools, from different parts of the country, who should have no way of knowing one another, have often become sort of excited and distracted, and until the presenter delivering the program has had to kind of stop and ask them what the problem is. And they've reported seeing a little girl waving from out behind the grill underneath the stage. Now, since the grill was removed, she hasn't been seen there anymore, but you can't actually see into the underneath of the stage. But I believe when they, our facilities team tell us that when they went under there to do some work under the stage, there was a crawl space because of the old kind of air conditioning manifold. It was one of the first buildings, I believe the first government building in the country ever to be fitted with air conditioning, though it was non-functional at this point. So it wouldn't really explain the phenomenon, but there was a gap that really no grown man could have fitted into. None of the men who were there to do the work could fit into it, but they could kind of spy down it, and it was a channel that would have fitted someone no larger than a child, of about the age the little girl who's seen is reported to be. And all through that channel they found things like little troll dolls and girls' hair ties and things of that order, so the sorts of property you might expect a child to collect. So it's one of the more disturbing stories, and also in one of the more corroborated, in that there have been a lot of independent sources who have reported seeing her there.
If I was a ghost, I'd want to show people that ghosts are real, as in they are the remnants of a living person that was once, you know, around on Earth. But no ghost seems to be able to do that. You, as a ghost, you want to be able to prove that you are that particular ghost of a person. And so I'd try and do that, but I'm sure a lot of others try and do that, but doesn't seem to happen. So maybe in the ghostly world you can't do that.
That story was by me, Samantha Gruth, and Alison Chan. Special thank you goes to Torsten Kading, as well as Anne Mackay and Tim the Yowie Man. You can catch Anne and Tim roaming around the National Film and Sound Archives on their ghost tours. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and future. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Community Coordinator. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. And I'm Samantha Gruth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and all our other episodes are at allthebestradio.com. If you liked this episode, send it to your friends that like almond milk, and subscribe on your favourite podcast app.